This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith, and we're doing something slightly different this week in that we're celebrating 100 years of forestry in Scotland, and we thought we'd let you hear the programme that we did called Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Yeah, the Forestry Commission was formed in 1919, mainly to develop pit props to keep the war effort going, and they formed it off the back of a lot of the forestry service in Malaysia and whatever. And it's really changed the way Scotland looks today. It's a fascinating story, and we were lucky enough to meet some of the folk that made that happen.
Well, they were a lovely bunch of folk. I have to say, it wasn't particularly easy getting to Monocacy Forest. It was up about 2.5 miles of dirt track. But what they were trying to do was celebrate an occasion, literally 100 years ago last Monday, where a tree was planted in Monocacy Forest, which lies about 2 miles west of Elgin. It was planted to mark the creation of the Forestry Commission in Scotland. Now, we met forestry commissioners, conservators, foresters, forest workers. They were a lovely bunch of folk. And I also caught up with a chap I haven't seen in years, Sid Howe. Sid's a former conservator. And I got him to give us the background to the setting up of the Forestry Commission.
Before World War I, we had a laissez-faire approach to growing timber. In other words, we just imported it from all over the world, from Empire, from Russia, from the Baltic. We grew 2% of our timber needs before World War I. During World War I, the U-boats, of course, put paid to a lot of ships, and that brought home the emergency crisis almost for timber, because we couldn't prop up the mines or build trenches because of lack of timber. And Lloyd George said after World War I, it was almost for lack of timber that we lost the war, not want of food. And the response to that crisis, influenced by people like Lord Lovett, was to set up a state forest service. And that's the origins of the Forestry Commission.
Tell us that story about Lord Lovett and the race to plant the tree.
It's a good story, actually. Well, unusually, the first actual meeting, the Forestry Act that set up the Forestry Commission, was passed in for beginning of September 1919. But the actual commissioners hadn't had to be appointed, and they didn't meet until round about the 8th of December, which was a Sunday. Highly unusually, yes. And civil servants and others are renowned for meeting on a Sunday. Anyway, at that meeting, and it was almost go home now and plant, mm-hmm. was almost the exhortation. And Lord Lovett, the first chairman, had a bet. He was a well-known gambler, Lord Lovett. And he then had a bet with an English lord, Lord Clinton, who had estates in Devon, about who could plant the first tree. And so they then raced off to the respective stations to get the trains back to their estates and properties. And when Lord Lovett got off the train in Inverness, he was handed a telegram saying, "You've lost." And Lord Clinton had beaten him by getting to Eggesford Forest, which was part of his estate. And these were subsequently to become Forestry Commission forests and had planted Douglas firs there. And those
but
were the first
Lord
trees.
Lord Lovett, it wasn't just the ego of planting the first tree. There was a sound economic plan there as well.
Oh, yes, and he had been part of the whole tradition of planting lairds, who saw planting trees and reforesting as part of the regeneration of the Highland economy. And he had undertaken a survey on at the behest of the Royal Scottish Forestry Society in 1911 to look at the Great Glen and the potential for forestry. And not just the forestry, he had quite an interesting vision about peopling the forest. And he looked to Bavaria, ironically, given the outcome of World War I, or who our opponents were. Lord Lovett had been to Bavaria and had seen a class of rural worker who had a small holding, a few cows, some sheep,
like
pigs.
Forest crofting, basically.
Forest crofting, yes. And I thought that was an ideal model for the Highlands. the Royal Scottish Forest Society had presented that to various public inquiries, and there'd been there was always a sort of push for doing it, but there was no compelling reason for doing it. And it took a world war, unfortunately, to put that right. After World War One, when the Forest Commission was set up, these forest worker holdings were put in place.
These are quite far-thinking people.
They were very far-thinking people. If he'd been doing it today, he would have been hailed as a land reform crusader. And I think it probably would have worked much better. At the time, there wasn't any capital to give these people money to, say, buy a tractor. There was no grants or anything like that. So they struggled a bit, and the idea sort of slightly withered on the vine. I mean, it's interesting. There are some who would say that the greatest legacy of World War One in rural Scotland was the Forestry Commission. Mm-hmm. And whilst, I'm biased, I work for the Forestry Commission, and I'm not blind to some of the things that happened, but if you take a 100-year experiment in changing land use, you're bound to get a few things wrong in that time. And you think of things like the forest villages. And if I think of Scotland and my favourite landscapes from round the Great Houses, the planting of trees at that time, actually in the 20th century, what's been the great landscape enhancement, for the most part, it's been the planting of trees.
Can we gather round, please?
I want to make sure that everybody's in hearing range, so can you all hear me? Great. On behalf of the Royal Scottish Forestry Society, I would like to welcome you all this afternoon. But I would particularly like to welcome our Minister, Fergus Ewing, Lord Lovett. We have Simon Hodgson somewhere, Chief of Forestry and Land Scotland, and we have John Thompson, Regional Manager. And very importantly, almost the most important, we have a former Forestry Commissioner in the form of George Stewart, who is 100 years old on Thursday. Today, simultaneously with our tree planting at 2 o'clock, precisely, Sir Henry Studholme, Chair of the Forestry Commission England, will be planting a tree at Eggersford to commemorate the planting there by Lord Clinton. OK, on your marks, I think. Is the spade sharpened? Good, thank you. Put it in gently, but then I have to make
sure it's not that. You've got a good pair of boots. Nanda's just given the current Lord Lovett detailed instructions on how to plant the tree. He's just untying the bundle. This is kind of happed up in membrane at the moment. It's an oak tree, probably about 6 feet tall.
Propose a toast, please, to absent friends in the next 100 years of forestry in Scotland.
George Stewart has been mentioned several times to us. You have the distinction of being exactly the same age as the Forestry Service in the United Kingdom. That's extraordinary.
Yes, I was born 3 days after the first planting of the trees, and 3 days later...
Your destiny was marked out in front of you.
Yes. Yes.
How many years did you work in forestry?
Oh, 30, just over 30. Not all that long, really. But, of course, there was the war. I mean, I was away for 6 years in the army, so that was at university, and so that takes up another 10 years, really.
And what did you do in the forestry?
What did I do? Well, I planted trees.
That's the main thing.
I ended up as the Commissioner for Forest and Estate Management, which meant that I was responsible for all the planting side of the estate. I wasn't involved in harvesting or marketing the timber, but much of everything else was my...
What kind of trees were you planting in those
days?
Oh,
mainly Sitka spruce, the ubiquitous Sitka spruce. It's so good. It's a wonderful tree, and it's a miracle tree in Scotland.
What makes it a miracle tree? Define that for me as a forester.
Well, it grows almost at any site and it produces very good timber. And if you get it in a big tree by itself, it's a lovely tree.
See, I've seen it on the west coast of America, where it is a different plant altogether. It's an enormous, yes, magnificent specimen.
Well, we don't allow them to grow so big. We like trees of about a foot in diameter. We don't really want timber much bigger than that. There are places, of course, in Scotland where sitka is going to a big size. It's lovely, yes, I agree. Wonderful, wonderful tree.
What about the fact of planting an oak to celebrate here today rather than a sitka species?
Well, I don't know who chose that, but it's a fair point. Oak, we want more oak, certainly. And I gather that this particular oak is one of local origin.
How do you think Lord Lovett did in terms of planting
the tree? Fine. Yes, fine.
You'd give him a job?
Absolutely.
When you started as a forester, I'm assuming that the driver, I mean, the very raison d'etre of forestry was to produce timber. Yes. That's not the case nowadays.
It's part of the case, but not all of it. No, we want more out of our trees now. We want them to provide shelter and places to go and walk and quietness and everything like that. Yes, we want places, of course, for wildlife. Yes, we take a much wider view now, correctly.
Former Forestry Commissioner George Stewart, who celebrated his 100th birthday just on Thursday there. Happy birthday, George. And you also heard the voice of Nanda Robertson, President of the Royal Scottish Forestry Society, getting the tree planting ceremony underway, and former Conservator Sid House.
You made the point to me on the Monday that we had hundreds, if not thousands, of years of forestry experience, yeah, just in that wee clearing, yeah, in the forest. It was incredible.
Well, what I find really intriguing about, I mean, you said earlier, it's a bit like a secret society. They're not a secret society, but there's a real sense of camaraderie, a shared experience, shared purpose. And to get to that location where the first tree was planted was really quite a challenge. You know, I mean, we were getting there by car, but, you know, these guys are accustomed, you know, and they were mostly male, not entirely, but these guys are accustomed to sort of finding locations literally in the back of beyond, in the middle of trees, and they all turned up. They were beautifully dressed.
Yeah.
Seemingly completely inured to mud, they didn't care.
There was people in sensible shoes, kind of knee-deep in mud, and
yes,
we were looking at the less sartorial end of the group.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the BBC let the side down sartorially rather badly.
Well, we were
a point Sid made to me.
Oh, yes, he did make that point. But we were dressed for the forest. Another thing that struck me, I hinted at it about sitka spruce.
Yeah.
Because they obviously love sitka spruce, because a lot of people absolutely hate it.
The miracle tree.
Yeah, hate it. You know, it's impenetrable. We can't walk through a proper sitka spruce plantation at the ages that most of the Forestry Commission plant them at. But fascinating stuff.
As George said to us, you know, the way they plant them is for a specific purpose, you know, and it's scientifically proven that it works for what they want to do. If you go to somewhere like the west coast of America and you see sitka there, and it can be a magnificent tree. It's a different animal altogether.
That was a real eye-opener for me. We got kind of 200-year-old sitka spruce, and it is magnificent, and it's huge.
Yeah.
Beautiful trees. Quite nice to have a few specimen trees like that.
There were certainly hundreds of years of experience in front of us on Monday in terms of the people just standing there and celebrating the centenary. But there's an awful lot more experience in forestry around about Scotland, and there was felt to be a need to actually record some of those experiences before it inevitably disappeared. Norman Davidson from Huntly, along with the late Gordon Urquhart, set up a website called Forestry Memories to record and keep alive the stories and images of those working in the woods. I mean, Norman told us how the website came about.
Well, it was part of a project that started about 2005, I think, and it was a project that historians decided to have a go at trying to collect the oral history of people around Scotland, of forestry people around Scotland, not necessarily Forestry Commission, but people from all walks of forestry life. And in the end, they pulled together about 150 individuals and did 2-hour, 3-hour, 4-hour sessions, and got their stories of forestry in Scotland, as it were.
What kind of thing was coming out of that?
It was just a whole range of different experiences. Sometimes it was wet weather, sometimes it was snow weather, sometimes it was fun, sometimes it was sad, and sometimes all sorts of incidents and episodes that we've long since forgotten. but they are recorded in their memories, and I think, and consequently now in the archives in Inverness.
It's funny, we were just talking about this, you know, trees can last hundreds of years, we don't, you know, and it's, you know, the people that planted those trees can just disappear off the face of the map, unless somebody like you set something like that up, you know, and you've actually got those stories archived now.
Yeah, I've worked on since 2007, right all the way through, and tried to get some stories, some images from ordinary people, from the ploughmen, the lorry drivers, from people who worked in forests, people who handled horses and things, and to try and give their story, and because their names are no longer recorded anywhere.
Were you a forester yourself?
I was indeed, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, well over 40 years, yes. In fact, nearly 45 years.
How did you find the experience? What attracted you to the job?
Well, I'm an islander from the north, where there is no forest.
Just wanted to see a tree, frankly.
Indeed, yes. That was possibly it. I was interested in timber, in wood itself, but I was always, since the age of about 14 or so, I was quite keen to go into forestry. And when the family moved down to Aberdeenshire, I moved down to Perthshire and started on Athol Estates. And the rest is history, as it were. That was about 1961.
Back then, was forestry a quieter business?
No, not really, because the squads were bigger.
So you didn't have the big machines, you had lots of men instead?
Lots of men instead, yes.
Oh.
And the stories and the episodes and the, let's say, devilment that people got up to if they were gathered together, like 20 people gathered together in a wet day in a shed or whatever, or under a hap as some said. There was a great opportunity for storytelling and in all these bothies and card games and whatever else went on, as it were.
The thing I've often wondered about a forester's career, you know, in the early days, maybe you plant some trees. 30, 40 years, maybe it's time for them to come down again. How does that feel?
I think a sense of pride, really. If that crop's grown well and you're start thinning it at year 30, as it were, and perhaps if you're very fortunate, you start felling it at year 50 or 60, it's, a sense of pride, really. You've provided a natural resource for Scotland, I think.
How do you think Scotland's going to look in another 100 years' time? Neither of us are going to be around to call you a liar, so you can please yourself.
Indeed. I would hope, I would hope that there would be more trees, an even more sympathetic attitude towards environment and natural living beings, as it were. I think we've got to make a little bit more room for them. And hopefully, I think we can perhaps lock up a bit more carbon as well.
In commemoration of your work with Forest Memories, they're giving you a lovely rose bowl there.
Yes, I'm very honoured to receive this. But in reality, I would really dedicate this to all the volunteers who've taken the time and trouble to tell their stories, to hand over their photographs for me to copy and put on the website. And it is really for them. And hopefully we'll add more and more of a history to that website.
Norman Davidson there. And the Forestry Memories website, it's an ongoing project. They haven't closed it or anything. It is still very much open. If you've got anything that you would like to add to it, stories, photographs, whatever, you'll find a link to it on our webpage. It is well worth a look.
I don't know about you, but that ceremony on Monday, you got a real sense of family.
It's strange you should say that, because, I mean, I really enjoyed it, and they made us very welcome. But this is going to sound a bit bizarre. In a way, it was like finding yourself in groups of soldiers or people who had served together. You know, you could listen to the stories, but, you know, we knew that we weren't part of it. You know, we weren't part of that shared experience, shared purpose and so on. But it is that, you know, it really felt that close to me.
Yeah, one of the contributors earlier on touched on it, it's a bit like being in the regiment.
Aye.
There's a piece coming up later on where I didn't realise the Forestry Commission was a uniform service, but a bit more on that later. It was actually through Norman. We were pointed in the direction of a couple of brothers, Charlie and Gordon Smith. Now, their story of life in the forest is, I'd never heard of it, and I'm pretty sure a lot of other people will never have heard of it. I visited them up in Huntley this week. Charlie's 90 and started working in the wood in 1948, and his brother Gordon, now 86, in 1948. There's at least four generations of Smith working in northeast forests. And I asked Gordon what his father did.
Well, he was a carter in the wood, horse carter. Well, eventually it came to tractor and caterpillars and so forth, right on.
And there was portable sawmills, is that right? How did that work?
Well, it was just a tractor and a single bench, and that was it, mining timber. Hmm.
So when you were young, your dad was moving round, was he?
He would have carted in to the sawmills with a horse and bogey.
So you're all living there, you're going to school. What happens when the cutting's finished?
I was shifted around, you see, the portable sawmills. Well, you just had another sawmill, like I tell you, portable.
You moved house and a whole lot moved, wooden house.
Well, so you took the house with you?
The house went with you. Mm-hmm.
So how did that, was that quite easily collapsible?
They're very good, fine, while it was sitting outside until the house was kind of set up for the night. Well, I remember once shifting from Boyne to Dromure the same day with a lorry, yeah, and my mother was making a supper at 5 o'clock.
That's what you did, and that was it.
So you were never in the same place for more than what?
No, well, he went to Nathy School for stuff, but I was never at Nathy School, but I went to school at Boyne, Dromure, and Cors, and Lumphanan. That was different schools that I went to.
That must have been quite difficult as you were young, going to a new school.
A wee bit, we got used to it.
Was a lot of people on the same boat?
No. Yes, well, take for instance Dromure for the summer. You go had three timber merchants alone in that district. Jones had two mills, Riddick had one, and Lockhart had two. And that's only in the size of Dromure. Riddick's when they were up at Tullybeggy and Dromure, they were all in, it was no, almost a street, timber houses. Well, there'd be a married couple in one house, probably a single chap and a bothy in the next one, then another married. And it was a good half mile houses, just in, for one sawmill.
So would these all be all portable houses?
Aye, all portable. And they were known as Riddick Sheds because they had the slope of the roof, nail near the peak of the roof.
Kind of a mini village.
Yeah, just a mini village. One of the teachers that I had at school referred to us as the barbarians from the woods.
Well, it must have been quite interesting when the whole circus rolled into town.
I mean, there was 21 huts, wasn't there?
Something like that.
Something like that.
It must have been quite a community.
Yeah, it's a good long road.
No running water, no electric lights, no.
What was it like? I mean, talk me through what that portable house was like inside.
Well, no, all right. It's actually new.
You just thought you knew, yes. Well, there was four brothers, us, and my mother had the heat flask for 8 flasks in the morning. She was up at the back at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Presumably you're not...
started at 7.
Presumably you're not all getting a bedroom each.
No.
So how many were sharing the bedroom?
Three, yeah, so three. There was four brothers, but there was three coming up at the same time, more or less. Four brothers and Vadin. 50 years at Sawmills.
Going back to the house, how did it all fit together? How did it work?
Just boards. Sections together.
Just putting peg together, or how was
it? It was simple.
Just in sections, and that was it.
So would your dad have made that?
I mean,
No.
They were all made.
Nah, yeah. Mm-hmm. My mother and that used to try and paper mine the inside of them, but it was old rough wood, and when the summertime hot weather came, the cracks appeared and up and down.
So your mother's trying to paper it to keep the wind out?
Exactly. But drinking water had to be carried probably... You was lucky if you got drinking water out of a well about 200 to 300 yards away.
What was your first job?
My first job, I left the school at 13 and a half. I got an exemption at 13 and a half. And I started at Jones.
So what was your job?
Picking planks off the end of the saw. But there was lots of shorties before that.
Well, you presumably were doing work in the bulk of the time when you were at school as well.
Yes, when the summer holidays came, you always had the jobs, and we used to, James Jones, the poles, you know, the electric poles and your telephone poles, We used to peel them in our holidays. That was a joke. I think we've got about 3 old pennies each for it.
So you're living quite a migrant life for a fair chunk of your childhood.
It's just...
So when did you finally get a permanent house?
Oh, no. Neither was married.
No, I too was married in 1958.
That must have been quite exciting as well.
Aye.
It must have been quite a unique upbringing. You look back at it fondly because it must have been quite hard in the winter.
It was hard. I think one of the winters back in 1940-41, when I was up at Goshney, I think it was 2 months, I never seen school. We had to go to course school, which was further, about 3 miles. We walked through fields and never had to go to school.
Must be a happy memory, though.
Ah, just...
Sawmillers Charlie and Gordon Smith. Fabulous. And the fascinating story of the Mobile Sawmill. See the next time the current Mrs. Stephen complains to me about the fact the house hasn't been decorated in a while. I'm going to point out that it could be worse. The wallpaper could be cracking every time the sun dries the boards.
Tar paper. It just conjures up such a wonderful image. And Charlie was telling me a bit later, because when they joined during the war, I think they both joined the Black Watch.
Aye.
Now, these guys are incredibly fit. Super fit.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie was saying when he joined the Black Watch, he put on 2.5 stone.
Wow.
Most folk...
2.5 stone?
Most folk go to the army and lose weight.
Aye.
And Gordon said he put on, I don't know how much, half a stone as well.
Aye.
Because the work was nothing like the work they were doing in the forest.
It must have been quite a shock for local communities, though, to have these, you know, because itinerant villages, they were moving villages, to suddenly turn up and land in the middle of them.
Well, the village school, you imagine the reaction with that. And they got 3 or 4 kids there, and suddenly there's 40 kids arrived.
Aye, quite. And they all know each other.
Yeah.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. We're looking at forestry this week. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds.
Yeah, this morning we're marking the centenary of the Forestry Commission. Monday, Mark and I were there for a tree planting ceremony just outside Elgin, where the first tree was planted in Scotland in December 1919. There'll be more great stories from Scotland's forest still to come, including Julian, who said, "I've contributed a third of the Forestry Commission's existence. I worked for them for 35 years. We're a strange bunch. We often don't get to see the fruits of our labours as the trees take so long. They're very popular now due to carbon capture. But if you fancy a career in the forestry and want to help with tackling climate change, there's no better job, in my opinion."
Well said. Just when we were there on Monday at Minochty, it was a happy experience and everybody had a lovely time, but there was a slight bittersweet tinge to it, because earlier this year the name Forestry Commission ceased to exist. There are now two separate agencies, Forestry and Land Scotland and Scottish Forestry. Simon Hodgson is Chief Executive of Forestry and Land Scotland, and I said to him, right, explain the difference.
Well, it's part of the long devolution process. It started 20-plus years ago, finally completed in April this year, and we've now got Forestry Commission down in England, Forestry and Land in Scotland, Scottish Forestry in Scotland. It's a better arrangement, closer to the politics, more focused on what Scotland needs, and I think setting us up for the next 100 years.
So you're now a government department as opposed to an arm's-length commission?
Agency of government, which sets us a little bit separate, but Mr Ewing's got to be on a leash. You know, if he pushes the button, I come flying backwards, otherwise I'm allowed to run around.
So is that better or more restrictive than the old system?
I think for the current era, it's better, because it connects me better to the politics and connects me and the Forestry and Land Scotland better to the rest of Scottish Government, a real advantage.
How would you define the difference between the two areas, Forestry and Land Scotland and Scottish Forestry? What do you both do?
Largely, pretty much the difference is that we look after the national forests, the forests owned by Scottish Government and all the land that goes with those, and Scottish Forestry really look after the grants and the regulatory side for the private sector and policy as well.
You say you're closer to the politics. Forestry, by its very nature, is very long-term. Politics, 4 or 5 year cycle. Is that not a difficult area?
Well, people like me are employed to work out how you address the shorter-term political objectives and the long-term political objectives while respecting the long-term nature of forestry. And if you go back to 1919 and look at the debates in the House of Lords and House of Commons, it's all about trying to find the space between the current politics and the need to stick at the job for 100-plus years in order to get any trees.
So what are the sort of, you know, the current political imperatives? I mean, what do the Scottish Government want you lot to do?
Yeah. Well, they want us to manage the forests that they own really well for timber, for wildlife and for people to enjoy. So first job, manage the forests well. Second job is to expand the benefits that we deliver from that. So much more focus on locking up carbon, much more focus on expanding the forest, much more focus on making the places enjoyable for people to visit and to, you know, healthy exercise and those sort of things. So all of the old things are still there. Good forests, good timber, quality produce, working with the private sector. A lot of the new things are all about engaging with what society wants out of forests.
Do you not have to turn a profit? Or can you factor in the recreational value? It's a complex thing.
It is a complex thing. And doing all the calculations together to produce a sort of giant number, some people call that natural capital accounting, it is possible. But if you know, if you haven't got the cash in the bank, you're going the wrong way. So our job is to manage the business financially successfully. Quite a challenge because we've got a lot of things to do that don't make money. But the more that we can use the forest resource to generate revenue, the more that we can invest back into expanding forests or doing the things that people want.
There's been a lot of talk about how many trees have been planted in Scotland. Does that necessarily mean that our forests are getting bigger?
The forest area is getting bigger in Scotland. There's obviously movement in and out of forests, renewable, you know, wind farms, you lose some trees, or you used to, perhaps less so in the future as they get bigger. And sometimes a bit of forest are lost for development, those sort of things. But generally, with the increase that's being funded through the grant schemes that Scottish Forestry and Scottish Government are running, forests are going to get bigger in Scotland. There's a lot of private sector investment coming in. It's a go place to put money, forestry.
Simon Hodgson, Chief Executive of Forest and Land Scotland. Now, we were talking to Norman Davidson earlier about his website, you know, basically the Forestry Memories. It's not the only source of social history as to the history of forestry in Scotland. Mary Stewart from the University of the Highlands and Islands is the author of a book called Voices of the Forest, A Social History of Scottish Forestry in the 20th Century. I met up with her at Craigvinian Forest near Dunkeld.
When there was a real boom was after the Second World War. And that's when whole villages were created for workers. And that's when there was a major push to get workers out from the cities.
In terms of the sort of bespoke villages that were made for Forestry Commission workers, there's one near Oban.
Dalavich?
Dalavich, yes. Dalavich,
Dalavich. I mean, it's quite big too. It's some, what, 60, 70 houses?
Yeah, something like that. I think, yes. And that's probably one of the most well-known forestry villages. It was created exactly to provide housing for forest workers. I think the first houses were built in about 1952. There was about 30 built, and the following year they built more and then expanded. And if you think about what was there before, it was just a farm. It wasn't that there was no one living there. I think the population around of that forest area was about 50 odd in 1907. By 1955, there was 295 people living in that quite isolated part of Argyll.
What were working conditions like? Because, you know, people go on about, oh yeah, it was pre-health and safety and what have you, but it must have been a tough gig, you know, hail, rain, shine, whatever.
Absolutely. I think it would make your hair stand on end in the back of your neck if you read or hear some of the stories. It was incredibly difficult and hard work. I was reading just the other day there an account of a forest worker's day in the winter in down in the Scottish borders, where up at seven they were staying in a bothy or a hostel, many of the men were, so the conditions weren't great in the first place. Get up at seven, pile into the back of a lorry and shaken and shuggled about for miles till you got to the where as far as the lorry could go, back out. These are open, but, you know, they maybe a canvas over the back.
A hap,
yes. The hap would come with them. They would, then he was describing how they would walk 3 miles to where they were going to be doing the work that day, in snow. And these were the pre-Gore-Tex days, eh? Yeah. And so it was woolies and heavy coats, probably some of them, that they'd taken back from wartime. And then they get to their site, but one of the worst jobs is draining. They have to drain the hillsides to get the water coming off so that they can, it's acceptable conditions for the plants, for the young trees. And that must be the worst job in the world, where you're there with a huge big spade working with other men, creating big drains, you know, all day. The drudgery must have been intense. And then, but actually it kept you warm.
I can imagine, but things like, you know, fly cup or, you know, lunchtime, did they have any shelter at all?
So often the hap was often a shelter of some sort, yes. And they'd not always, but they retire to this hap. Houf was a name for it. Tea shack was the one the road squad called it. And the bigger ones were straight off the back of the lorry.
Aye.
And they'd take them up in the canvas. You got back to that as quick as possible because you didn't want to be the one
on the outside.
But then the ones in the core of it are the ones that were, not that they would worry, but they're smoking like like nothing. You know, everybody's smoking and talking, and there's some classic stories about how important the hap was for the men. I think the hap and the tea shack was probably the core of a lot of the jolliment that went on, the fun and the banter and the stories of them in there with their fuel, petrol for their whatever, if they've got machinery, you know, and later in the 60s when there was chainsaws, they're sitting on the cans of fuel, sip smoking, reading the paper and playing cards. And I know people will look through rose-tinted glasses back at the past, and nostalgia is something in oral history you have to factor in, but many of the people we talked to, it was the best days of their life. They were, you know, young families, life was good, it was very social, and they look back at that as hard work, but they enjoyed it tremendously.
My name is Gordon Fraser. I started the Forestry Commission in 1975. Our forester was a guy called Jack Freighter, a boy called Jack Freighter. And he got me in the job and says, would you like to join the forestry? I said, aye. I says, aye, what do I need to do? Do I need some qualifications? No, you don't need qualifications. Just come in the nursery and we'll show you how to learn how to grow young trees into certain trees at 12 inch. And then we'll go up, take them up the field and plant them. And that was it. There was over, there would have been 12 of us, 12 lads those days.
So what, these trees?
These trees here, yep, all the Sitka spruce trees, yep. Uh-huh. And as far as you could see, and then goes right back up at the Burgie end, uh-huh. This tree's been planted there as well.
How do you get them so regular?
How they get them regular? Well,
because you could more or less take a tape measure between those, and it'd be more or less
well,
the same.
They're all being measured every 2 meters. Uh-huh. A plant, every tree is planted every 2 meters, uh-huh. And so you can actually see what's there.
And was that ploughed? So you knew where to put it.
Yes, it was called a scarifier. It was scarifier with a big sort of tractor with uh-huh. two big blades that then used to scrape along the top of the surface of the ground. It's the excitement time when we do planting trees, and when you get older and you can look at your trees now, I says, oh, one of these days I might come back in and cut these trees again.
Now, you were trained to cut down really big trees.
That's correct, yes. Way back in again, in the 80s, I was picked to go on a special course, a week's course, to cut down bigger trees. So when the years went by, we had these special guys from down England. They were looking for certain trees for this boat. Uh-huh. I presume it was the rose.
The Mary Rose?
Mary Rose, yes. Okay. Yes.
So you're looking at oak then, are you?
It wasn't oak. There wasn't oak. They were wanting spruce. Uh-huh. And this is the spruce trees you see here just now.
What was it for, the masts or something?
It was to do with the hall, I think. Okay. It's part of the hall. Okay. So the guys come up and measured the tree, and they had this, we call the borer. Mm-hmm. And they bore the tree, and they took the sample out, and then once they got it all measured up, and they were the perfect size. So in my job, unfortunately, I had to go and cut the trees down, not myself and two other lads. So we got them down,
snedded all the branches off them, and then we couldn't get them out of the forest. So what do we have to do? So we have to phone these guys again from down south, bring them up to measure them on 8.5 metres. But they were too heavy. So we have to get these big giant caterpillars to skid them out of the woods. Uh-huh. And actually, it's just down where you are down today.
See, when you cut down a tree that size... Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm talking something like about, it looks like about, the way you had your arms out.
Five guys
holding hands around about this tree. And what, yeah. How long does that take?
Well, one cut, we call the mouth, they cut the tree in the mouth. It takes about like an hour and a half to cut through these big trees.
So you have a big, long, huge chainsaw?
Yes, we had the, they were called the Johnson Reds. They were the heavy Canadian-type saws, and they were about 22-inch bars, which say they make a mouth, and then when you're doing the main cut, we call half moon. It's a half moon cut, and then you put wedges into the woods. Then when you do another half moon, I could see me putting in 5 or 8 wedges into the tree. Now, the secret is, if it's a windy day, you just keep hammering it, and it's a step. So the step when
it's
the
like
wind,
a hinge.
Like a hinge, that's correct. And then the tree will go. Then once the tree goes down, this is when the excitement bit comes out. Boom. The whole ground shakes and everything. That's the heavy tree.
You're talking about tons and tons and of timber hitting the ground.
I would say you're looking at maybe 5 ton, maybe more.
If you get that wrong, you're in a bad place.
I'm afraid so. We had many people... near misses at the time. Aye. That was like my best experience in cutting trees these days.
Good career?
Yes. I've been here now 40 years. Yes, and I know every inch of this forest back my hand.
Will you miss it when you have to go?
I would miss it, yes. Oh, we miss all my work colleagues, yes, when we do go. We have to go sometime. So I think my time's is... ready to go next year. So I'm looking forward to enjoy my retirement.
Gogs Fraser there, and earlier we heard from Mary Stewart.
Just incredible stories. And Muriel from Lochmaben has said, I remember the Forestry Commission lorry taking the wives into Moffat every Thursday for the shopping, as most wives didn't drive in those days. What a picture it must have been, with the women and the children and the prams sitting in the canopy in the back of the truck. What an image. And Sue in Strathdon says, cosy with a cup of tea by the fire this morning and fascinated and awed by the hard life of Charlie and Gordon as foresters in the forest. Great programme. Thank you.
Peter's emailed in saying, my auntie Annie, Annie Reid, ran the forestry hostel in Glenmore in the middle of the last century, and one of my uncles gave up a job as a grocer in Aberdeen to branch out and join the Forestry Commission. I'm sure that I remember him saying that they had to plant a certain number of trees in a day, and the best way to meet the target was to bury a few, plant one, bury a few, and so on. A man after my own heart.
Yeah, the police will be around later on today. We were both remarking, as you said earlier on, how smartly everybody was dressed, despite the fact there was loads of mud. Now, I was especially taken by a man wearing what looked to me like a jacket straight from The Sound of Music.
I'm Bryce Rennard. I was in the Forestry Commission 42 years, and I've been retired 15 years now, and I've worked all over Scotland, and from Argyll right up to the Cairngorms, and in research as well, so plenty of variety.
My name is Elizabeth Rennard.
And you've been all over the place.
All over the place. We lived in Mull for 5 years. We went to Glenmore. We were there 3.5 years, and the Borders as well.
So what's that like, kind of constantly moving around?
Well, actually, it's quite exciting at times. Sometimes it's a bit of a challenge.
So how does that work? Does Bryce apply for a job or does he get sent somewhere?
Well, in those days, you get sent. You would come home and there would be a little letter underneath the doormat saying, you will go to live in Mull. And I live in a place called Pennygale, and you get the map out and you look up Pennygale and you think, can't find it. It's so small.
I mean, that, as you say, could be exciting, but it must be quite disruptive as well because you've got 2 young children.
Well, yes, it was all right when they were young, because in Mull they went to a school with 5 children, and 2 were them. But we were settled when they went to Peebles High.
you stood out a wee bit. Because tell me about your fancy jacket.
Right, I've got a fancy jacket on. This goes back to the 1960s. This is very much like a paramilitary uniform, as the Forest Commission was, like the Met Office or the Ordnance Survey. And it's a tweed jacket with a red collar and gold crowns on the epaulettes. And this was what foresters wore in those days. It was a matching jacket and trousers.
Well, you would actually wear that in the forest?
Yes, but it didn't last long in the Sitka Spruce. To get ripped to shreds.
It's not terribly practical. It's a bit like the Count and the Sound of Music, kind of his outfit.
Well, thank you. A bit of flattery there.
That was one of the original forestry outfits. And in fact, when I was a little girl and going to school, I used to see the forester wearing that uniform.
You must have seen huge changes in the Forestry Commission.
I think a lot of the changes is, in my young day, there were no female foresters for a start, and there was no computers and all these sort of things, and foresters, you're outside most of the time, whereas nowadays I think most foresters are inside looking at screens or driving a vehicle. In my generation, strange as it sounds, most of us foresters were townies, came into the country, and all the country boys wanted town jobs, but most of us foresters were townies.
How do you feel, you know, here we are celebrating 100 years of something that doesn't exist anymore?
Sad. Really sad. You know, we put a lot of work into it. And it's not just trees, but it's people and families and wives and so on. And so a bit sad it's not been celebrated more. But I can say that now I'm retired.
Did you miss the actual commission? You know, it's a great brand.
It's very much a family firm. I can come to a meeting like this and recognise lots of people, and we actually have lots of reunions as well. And we're very much a family. I'm the chairman up here of the Retirement Association, so we have lots of get-togethers.
Did you enjoy the time?
Yes, I did. And we were transferred up to Inverness. It was supposed to be for the usual 3, 5, 8 years maybe. 30 years later, we're still here. They changed the rules.
What about the future, then? How do you see it? It's potentially a very different organisation, no matter what it's called.
It's a different organisation, but it's very much still in need. We still need trees and all their various reasons why we have them. And the reasons changed. In my young day, when I started in the 1960s, one of the main sources for timber was for pit props, whereas now it's more environmental side, trees for carbon uptake and things like that. So basically we try and put trees in the right place for the right reasons and hope that when they mature, when we're dead, they'll be of use to somebody for some reason.
Bryce Renard there and his wife Elizabeth, and as Ewan said, Bryce was just so smartly dressed. One of the main organisers of the replanting ceremony was John Thompson of Forestry and Land Scotland. John's the regional manager of the East Region. How big an area is that?
That's everything from Nairn pretty much down to Kelty. So it's Moray, Aberdeenshire, Aberdeen City, part of the National Park, and then Angus, Perth and North Fife.
That is a huge area.
In terms of forestry terms, it's almost exactly 90,000 hectares.
So is this a bit of a sad day or a double-edged sword kind of a day? The end of an era and a whole new beginning?
I hope it's a new beginning. I'm sure it is. It's not really the end of an era, it's a continuation, really. Between my father and I, we've 58 years invested in this business. It's our family business. It stops with me, I'm afraid. I grew up here, I lived here for 18 months when I was a youngster. So I'm delighted to see us celebrating 100 years of, in my opinion, unbridled success.
I was just talking to a chap up the top of the road there, Goggs, who planted these trees. You know, that must be a really strange sensation to look at a landscape and think, I fundamentally changed that, whatever it was, 40 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a long-term game. You're acutely aware of that. If you stay in the industry long enough, you'll find yourself felling the trees that you've planted. And there's always a wee bit of a tinge of sadness with that, but that's part of the cycle, that's part of the crop. It's what we do. So you're taking out something, you're putting something else in new. And if you're lucky and you've got good health, you can see a generation and a half of a timber crop, and it's lovely to do that.
Here we are, I'm looking around, you've got the occasional native woodland, but it's mainly conifer, almost 95% conifer. And we're going to be planting an oak. It's going to be the only oak in the forest.
Absolutely not. If you look at what we do, we run a mixed economy, so the Sitka spruce that you're looking behind us, that's what pays the bills. You know, it's great having a wide diversity of species, and everybody in forestry would want that, but it's got to be profitable, it's got to be sustainable.
When your dad started this job, presumably it was about producing timber, end of.
huge changes nowadays.
That's correct, although we still, using East Region as the figure, we're looking to produce 500,000 cubic metres of timber a year on average. Yeah. So it's still an economic powerhouse, there's no question of that whatsoever. But we've become more multi-purpose, and that's the right thing to do. So we're much more sensitive and aware of ecological impacts, landscape impacts and social impacts. So, you know, we talk a wee bit about timber production at 500,000 cubic metres, but the same region accommodates 3 million day visitors from the public every year. We do rallying, we do mountain biking, we do lots of people that walk their dogs, ride their horses, just enjoy the landscape, come out here, read a book. It's for everybody and it's phenomenal.
John Thompson there, the highly enthusiastic manager for the East Region Forestry and Land Scotland.
It's great. Muriel Robinson's been in touch. My late husband and I, Ian, started our married life in 1964 at a forest near Beatwick in the Forestry Commission House, which was the norm in those days. It was his first post of many as a forester around South Scotland Conservancy, where he spent his whole career of 40 years in various posts, his final post being in management training at the Forest of Ay. He witnessed many plantations being felled for which he'd been responsible for planting.
Yeah. Peter says many, if not all, of the men evacuated from St Kilda in 1930 ended up working for the Forestry Commission, having never seen a tree before. Now, interestingly, Dan Holland from Inverness, producer up there, emailed me quite recently to say that he heard a story once that they planted trees on the slopes in the A82 through the Great Glen because the St Kildans didn't know where trees were supposed to grow. Yeah. And it's in such a vertiginous slope, they've never been able to harvest them since. There is nothing can get up in at them, and it's causing them real problems nowadays. Anyway, let's go back to former Forestry Commission Conservator Sid House. We heard from Sid right at the very start of this hour. I just wondered how Sid felt that the Forestry Commission no longer exists in name.
It's interesting, I thought a bit about that, and it's a bit like the regiments. You know, strong commitment to them, an esprit de corps, and I feel part of that seeing some of my former colleagues here today, friends and former colleagues. But what I'm reasonably confident at, as I think the foundation that's been laid down is pretty good, and I know there are new challenges and new organisations, I'm reasonably confident that because the foundations are quite solid, roots, there's a good analogy for forestry, that I'm confident the next 100 years are going to be good. Now, you just have to think of the current prevailing debate on climate change, agriculture in struggling in marginal parts of Scotland. And if you think that 100 years ago, it was either the lairds or the state who were managing forests, look at today. We've got community groups, we've got woodland trusts and other charitable organisations, including the one I'm now associated with, the Royal Scottish Foresters Society. We've got investment forestry, we've still got the lairds, we've still got the state. We've got a much more diverse and interesting, and farmers, and there's always been a little bit of antipathy between farming and forestry, and there's a long programme we could do on that, I'm sure. But actually, you now start to see farmers getting much more interested in trees because they understand that they can heat their holiday homes, keep their grain dryers going, or their houses warm through using wood chips or logs. So they're getting the message. And I think that's the reason, that's why you go past Lockerbie, you see a plant there that burns off biomass, you see the sawmills, you know, you go just down the road here to Dalcross and you get the factory there that's making materials out of timber. And it's that strong investment. I think, you know, I'm quite confident the next 100 years are going to be, if anything, probably better.
Former Conservator Sid House there.
It's just been a fascinating insight into a lot of things I didn't know. I didn't know they wore a uniform in the woods. I didn't realise they had these portable buildings.
Yeah. And they lived portable villages, never mind buildings.
Incredible itinerant lifestyle. It's just, the trouble is, Forestry Commission is huge in Scotland, but it's something that most people in this country don't know a huge amount about. It just quietly goes on and quiet parts of Scotland. Fascinating stuff.
Well, you finished off there by asking Sid, you know, if he felt a twinge of sadness at the fact that the Forestry Commission is no more a name anyway. And he referred to it as almost like the sort of the regiments of Scotland. It does have quite a military ethos.
Yep.
You know, certainly everybody, you know, we were the scruffiest two there by a country mile, I would say. Everybody else was very smartly dressed and seemingly completely inured to mud. It didn't matter how filthy they got.
But you got that sense of camaraderie that was, which we weren't a part of it. They were all greeting like old friends, they were sharing stories. You know, and there was generations of experience there. You know, 100-year-old forester. And
George Stewart.
And the guys Charlie and Gordon, 80, 90. Yeah. Fantastic stuff.
Just extraordinary. It was a privilege to meet them, and thank you very much to everybody who took the time to actually speak to us. Sadly, that's all we've got time for on this podcast. We will be back next week with yet another one. But from all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for downloading us.